Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Yes, this is your host, Brett King. I am here in New York, live from New York City. It was raining this morning, but the sun came out, and it's quite a nice day. I am joined by my good friend, Jason Hendricks. Welcome back, Jason. And he's gonna pipe in any second now. And we are, of course, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast with over 6.5 million listeners in 180 countries. So Jason and I are going to endeavor to work out what it takes to do digitally successful at a traditional bank today. We have USAA's Neff Hudson joining us. He's going to talk about USAA's digital transformation, their digital DNA. They're one of the better banks at this. We'll be comparing notes as to why USAA have succeeded where Chase's Finn and HSBC's Connected Money recently failed. So that's sort of going to be the conversation. But joining us also all the way from Munich in Germany is Paolo Cerroni. He is IBM's global fintech lead for the Watson practice. Paolo, welcome to the show.
Buonasera.
So listen, we're going to be talking about Paolo's recent essay he's done on financial transparency and how economics are changing in the digital era. We're going to talk to him about IBM Watson's latest stuff that they're doing in fintech. We'll get to that in the second half of the show, but for now, we want to start focusing on some of this digital disruption. Before we get to that, though, a few conference announcements. September the 23rd to 26th, the Breaking Banks team is going to be at Sibos. We will be the exclusive podcast for Swift in a tribe. We'll have the whole gang there: Chloe James, myself, Jim Marus, Dave Birch, Katie King, Jay and Tanya from Provoke Management are going to be there also. It's going to be our biggest Sibos appearance yet for Breaking Banks. We're going to be live broadcasting from the event. We're going to be do a ton of recordings, tapings, so book signing. There'll be giveaways, T-shirts, all that stuff. We are going to be all over Sibos and Swift, so we really hope that if you're there in London, September 23rd to 26th for Swift, you'll come and say hi to us in the Inner Tribe Zone and join the Breaking Bank teams. Now, if you're a senior leader with P&L responsibility from a bank or credit union, and you're looking for ways to create new sources of value, or you've been tasked with building or managing an innovation function within your organization, you should check out the BAI Innovation Summit, October 8 to 10 in Boston. Of course, Breaking Banks is going to be there. JP Nichols and Jason Hendricks will be representing the Breaking Banks team there. They'll be conducting an interactive hands-on session that will take you through an empirical approach to value creation, designed to maximize results and minimize wasted efforts. Now, if you guys have been listening to the show, you'll know that Jason and JP also run the FinTech Forge, which is an innovation lab effort for multiple banks in the United States. So they have access to these strategic frameworks, these lenses to help you pursue these innovation ideas that are aligned with strategic priorities. And you really need this sort of approach to innovation if you're in the existing business today to make a difference, for doing something different. So find out more information or to register, go to BAI.org. Now, in the fintech news this week, you've seen Uber getting into fintech. Now, this is not unusual because we've got Grab and Go and Jet and Didi Chung in China. A lot of these transportation taxi service type apps are getting into fintech elsewhere in the world. So it was an obvious pivot, I think, for Uber to make. We'll see whether it... it beds in, whether
I think you've actually been beating this drum the longest that, you know, if you think of the original problem Uber was solving, it's what you've been calling that embedded commerce aspect or embedded banking, which is there a worse time to be thinking about making a payment than getting out of a taxi, right? And, you know, exactly. Especially in New York City with people honking and it's raining. So it's natural that if I fix the payment piece for the customer, why shouldn't I be fixing it for the driver, right? Like embedded across the value chain.
Right. So Uber, of course, offers their drivers their own Uber driver debit card. They did this because when they were trying to grow their business in 2014 and 2015 in cities like New York and Chicago and San Francisco, they ran into growth issues because about 30% of the drivers who were starting the sign-up process were abandoning it because they didn't have a bank account. They'd come from the yellow cab industry and been paid in cash. So they had to innovate around banking to grow their business. It's a really good example of synergistic commerce, as you say, Jason. Elsewhere in the news, Banco Sabadell has invested in Active AI. We see more investments in this. You guys might recall TD made an investment in Layer 6 last year, an acqui-hire there of an AI team. But the big news in the US this week, of course, is that N26 and Monzo are both coming into the US market and making a lot of noise about this week, and Revolut has entered the Australian market because the new fintech licensing structure in Australia allows for fintech licensees out of the UK to have a presence there. So that's pretty interesting. But listen, I want to get into digital transformation and what's happening in terms of banks who are responding to this. But what I'll do is in a moment, I'm going to get Matt, our engineer, to run this clip. It's a clip from Bloomberg TV. Jeremy Kahn is there speaking to Anne Bowden from Starling Bank in the UK. Matt, can you run that clip for us, please?
Let's try and analyse what the big banks, the incumbents, are doing at present. Number one, they're taking the new guys in the blob very seriously. Secondly, they're trying to create, say, flanker brands or new innovative brands that can move faster on the side. Some of those are, well, most of them are actually failing. It's very, very difficult to do that. But they will have to face up to a world where margins are lower. People like TransferWise have totally changed the price points for foreign exchange. And foreign exchange was a cash cow in the incumbent banks. So the response of the big banks to what's happening is what you have to analyze. And I think they will decide.
So we got the gist of, Ian's clip. Digital transformation and digital branches are two of the buzziest trends in banking right now. Now, there are some successful digital transformation efforts that you can see as success stories. Simple was acquired by BBVA and has more than tripled in size since the acquisition back in 2013. And that includes swapping out their bank partner, integrating with BBVA's core, etc. TD has successfully integrated with Brett's company, Movin, and since they launched that in their Canadian business, they have close to 2 million customers on TD's MySpend, a standalone app. TD also acquired Layer 6 last year to boost their AI capabilities. But for every successful launch of a digital pure play approach or a pairing with a fintech, we have some of the most dramatic stories coming out just this week. Finn, launched by Chase, going after the millennials, is being canned just a year after launch. And HSBC's secretive Project Iceberg, which became Connected Money, was also shut down last week. It's as if they were just waiting for someone else to go first so they could axe it themselves. Now, one bank in the U.S. that has been at the forefront of digital transformation is USAA. I joined USAA as a West Point cadet back in 1992, and despite the nearest branch being 1,822 miles away, they still had products tailored to my needs that made the dependence on mail, and worse, actually getting hazed while standing in line as a plebe to bank by phone, it was still worthwhile. They've come a long way since then, launching the very first check deposit functionality in the U.S. way back in the early 2000s, and that was actually by fax, not by phone. They also allow digital sign-up for all their products and services. In fact, they're only one of two traditional banks in the U.S. who have successfully transformed all of their products to be available via digital sign-up, just USAA and Capital One. Meanwhile, we have a host of insurgents, digitally native banks like Simple, Move, and Chime, Bank Mobile. You know, as Brett said just today, Monzo and N26 making big splashes coming to the U.S. So in the midst of this, why are some succeeding and some failing? So Neff Hudson is a 17-year veteran of USAA, starting as a web producer in 1999 when that wasn't a common title, spending 6 years at the helm of emerging channels and now leading corporate development. So now, with USAA's customers spanning the globe, they had a bit of a branch crisis, right? You can't reach central Afghanistan all that easily. So was necessity the mother of digital innovation, you know, that really drove this, or were there other strategic imperatives at work?
Well, hey, thanks for having me on the show today.
Yeah, welcome to the show, Neff.
I think that's a great intro. I mean, for us, it really was an imperative. And, you know, it's really sort of a compact history. It's about a 20-year history. We grew up direct, right? We started off as an insurance company founded literally by our membership in 1922, and we didn't get into the banking business until much later. And but we were always a direct company. So we used to do our insurance business directly. We used to do our banking directly. And in the old days, that was over the phone or via mail. And when the web came along, we were actually sort of late to the party. I think we first distributed, some standalone banking software in about 96, 97, where we were literally, bank was established in 83. We literally distributed, you know, hard disks, floppy disks, so you could load up and do PC banking 96, 97. But we didn't go live on the web until 99, which is actually when I joined USA. So I've been here about almost 20 years this year. So we were a little bit late to the party, but I think we really gained momentum after it because we are a direct bank. We immediately saw the utility, and we knew that we had to put pretty much the whole bank online. So we started off, the first 10 years of that was really focused on .com. And what we found during that period was when you try to adapt bank products or insurance products also in our case to that digital environment, you had to do a fair amount of reengineering. And you had to really rethink, you know, from a fundamental level, what you were as a business. So we really had to simplify. We had to reorganize the website around personal finance. So we were relatively early to get aggregation in place and to actually try to create a personal balance sheet or ledger balance, if you will, as the heart of the experience. And I think by really taking over, creating a 360 view of all the accounts that you had with USAA, giving you aggregation capabilities so that you could pull in your accounts if they were held away. I think that really got us off to a great start in terms of, you know, momentum around, you know, the website and creating a continuous conversation with our membership around their finances. But the build out of all those applications and capabilities, you know, took an incredible amount of focus, a lot of funding, and, you know, so we just, you know, built as fast as we can really from about 2000 to about 2015, even if you want to look at that. But it was by necessity, and that's absolutely the mother of invention.
So, Neff, we had you on the show some years ago. Actually, you were on like our second or third episode, I think, of Breaking Banks back in 2013. So it's something like that. You were very early on in the process. So we've been watching your progress along the way. But this sort of approach you're talking about is sort of like the 360 customer view, the single customer view type stuff that we used to hear a lot about in the late 90s, early 2000s. But did that really change your sort of core architecture from that point forward? Would you say that you became more of a technology-driven bank than just putting that sort of front layer on access to the web?
Yeah, absolutely. The first part, though, was to create a digital relationship, right? So by giving them the 360 view, by creating a place where they could come that really felt like the home for their finances, that allowed us to build out all sorts of capabilities underneath that and gave us permission to have all sorts of conversations, like what next product you should purchase or consider, how you should protect your credit score. How you should start saving for retirement, how you should start saving for emergency funds. So by really focusing on the transactions at a personal level, it gave us license to add a whole bunch of functionality beyond that. So it feels sort of basic now to say 360 view for members, but back then that was huge. And what it allowed us to do was really get a picture into needs and really understand what people were trying to do. We used to always be amazed how many times people would check their balances, for example. And we saw this behavior both on .com and then later on mobile, people looking at their
balances. It's always the number one thing people do with digital. Right?
Yeah, 10, 20 times a day.
Doesn't matter which bank, where you are in the world, the number one requested piece of information is account balance.
And so what are they really trying to tell you, though, Brett? So if someone's checking their balance five times, they're either waiting for a check to clear, they're waiting for a check to come in.
Yeah.
And so,
or they're checking how much they can spend when they're out.
Exactly. And so, you know, that's given us insight. And to be honest, we still have a lot of work to do to be able to act on those insights in near real time and, you know, to really provide that personalized financial advice that they're craving. But that's really given us the insight that we've needed, I think, to run sort of a high-level strategy against that for the last decade or so.
So I'm curious, you're giving your customers a 360-degree view of their finances, but, you know, most banks are pretty siloed places. What kind of organizational challenges did you face to now deliver? You're giving the customer a 360, but inside the bank, you're not acting in that same 360. How did you have to change?
Yeah, it drove an awful lot of physical and personnel change, obviously, over this period, this 20-year period. It started off as really an enterprise function. Digital was an enterprise function. And there really wasn't a lot of expertise in the bank or the insurance company that was native to digital. So we sort of recruited directly in, you know, to an enterprise hub. But we ultimately started pushing people out into the companies. And now, of course, we're hiring digital natives like everybody else. So with, you know, five generations in the workforce. But I mean, most of these guys that we're working with now sort of grew up either with mobile, but definitely with .com. So it's different now, but at that point we had to sort of seed some talent and then push it out into the companies. And at this point, I think a lot of that sort of personnel transformation is probably done simply because society has sort of caught up. But at that point, a lot of it had to be centralized and pushed out as opposed to sort of grow up natively in the companies, because they were much more focused, obviously, on just running the product and making sure that it was working well from that perspective. We were much more focused on distribution and how that was really going to work for the member.
So we've heard BBVA and DBS in Singapore and others talk about the fact that they feel they have to be a technology company in the future to survive, right? And so they've really started to change their leadership to reflect that. How technology savvy has the leadership of USAA become as a result of this directionality around servicing customers through digital?
Well, I think we talk about it pretty much all the time and obsessively in terms of, you know, we see the technology as a key enabler to what we're trying to accomplish. It's not technology for technology's sake. It's not that we're ever doing that just to, you know, put some shiny new chrome out there. What we're really worried about
is at your core.
Yeah. And so, you know, I can remember, you know, being front and center with the CEO back in 2007 trying to explain our strategy. I mean, it's always been very top down and, you know, very much emphasized from the very senior leadership of both the bank and the enterprise itself, that this was our future. And it's been our future since, you know, really 99. So I think because we were direct, we came to the party a little bit late on the website, but, you know, since then, the transformation has been continuous. And if you look at our structure now, I mean, back in 99, 2000, we were very much product siloed. We were very much, you know, in aligned by company. Now we have things called experience owners, where they actually, you know, track not just a product, but how a member interacts with a product across a period of time. Everything from learning about it, acquiring it, maintaining it, and disposing of it. And so we have someone who pays attention to every one of our core products, and below that, sub-process level, where they're looking at every touch point along the way to figure out how we can get better. And that's not exclusively to digital. I mean, that also involves, when do people need to bail off the mobile phone and actually talk to a person? When's the right time for us to follow this up, you know, with a, oh my gosh, maybe even a piece of paper, right? So, I mean, there's still things that, there's a lot of work to be done still here, but we think there's a lot of value in really scripting the experiences across channels, understanding when to escalate a contact, understanding, you know, when the letter needs to be there, when to reach out with a particular message. And, you know, there's still a lot of to-dos on that list, but we really feel like getting more and more personal and looking at it more and more holistically is the way to go.
So what sort of support do you get at the board level for this, these changes you've made over the years?
Well, you know, I actually brought a young buck named Brett King down here at one point to talk to my bank board and
back in 2014 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was way back. Yeah, and so they've always been curious about it. I would say that, you know, again, most of our board members have come out of a military background. They're very comfortable with technology. Technology is obviously applied, you know, throughout the military. So I think they all understood the value straight up. I think where we've had really healthy discussions is on how we can maintain, you know, our exceptional level of service even as we go, even as our digital interactions sort of outstrip personal interactions by 10 to 1, you know, more and more ratios like that we're seeing. So when's the right time to make sure that we're providing that human presence, you know, versus just, you know, pushing out the, you know, the digital capabilities? And we have these terms that we call, one of the terms we're really sort of focused on is, what does it mean to humanize digital? And we're not there yet. And as an industry, we're not there yet. And it's still sort of a cold, isolated place. And we're doing our best, you know, to make it all about you and to make it all about, you know, making better decisions in the moment and achieving what you want to do. I think we also have to be realistic in that context. One of the things that has always, you know, sort of amused me privately is we think about the members obsessively. Like, we spend all day thinking about our membership. The members think about us for about 20 seconds. It's like, I got 20 seconds to get something done. And if we're not good in that 20 seconds, we are dead. And so, you know, as much time as we think about them, what we're really doing is giving them the luxury of not having to think about us, right? I mean, as long as we got the lights on and we're ready to go and they've got that, you know, 2 minutes in the middle of the day to resolve a financial problem, then we're doing our job. But, you know, this idea that we're suddenly going to get, you know, our entire membership talking to us 2 hours a day about their finances, that's not happening.
Well, it's funny that's the misnomer, right? We think about it all the time and obsess and use the terms that our customers just kind of want to get the job done. So I'm curious, for all of your success, why do you think, you know, Finn, you know, there are no dummies over there at Chase. You know, they did a very large test of this in a core market before rolling it out. You know, why do we see, you know, such a big push like Finn failing and HSBC? And, you know, to Ann's point, most of these other initiatives by traditional banks are flaming out. What do you think's driving that?
You know, I can't really, I'm not an insider, obviously, on either one of those cases. So, you know, I can't speak to what they went through on their journey. But I can also tell you that managing platforms is an expensive business. And managing two platforms is probably three times more expensive than trying to manage one. So, I mean, there might have been some practical considerations that they had to look at. I mean, they were essentially trying to build a brand, but, you know, they had a brand already. And so were they sabotaging from the other brands? I mean, there's just, whenever you start to launch something else, you know, you have to build that capability and brand up. For us, it's always been about USAA, and we've resisted every call internally to split up the app. You got to remember, it's not just a banking app that we're delivering. We've got an insurance app on there too. It's got a whole bunch of claims capability in it. I mean, we connect to drones, you know, on the claims side. So, I mean, there's all sorts of capability that's buried in there, an auto shopping experience. And what we've really, you know, from time to time, when I was running .com for 10 years and then mobile for 7, I would get the call, hey, Neff, we got to split up the app. And I'd say, no, not going to do it. Not going to distribute more than one app, because the moment you do, you got, you know, twice the headache at least. And you got the expense of distributing it. You've got the expense of trying to keep the code bases aligned if you're running off of a similar one in the background. So there's an awful lot. They were paying a premium to run both of those, and at some point it probably just didn't make sense. The other major trend that you're looking at worldwide is the cost of acquisition for customers. Mary Meeker's report just came out, I think, 2 days ago.
Yep,
with 2 days. Some really interesting, really interesting data around customer acquisition costs, you know, rising across the globe, but especially in mobile financial apps. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, the lifetime value of the customers might not even outstrip the acquisition cost, in which case, wow, that's not sustainable. So, you know, I think it might be tied to some broader trends and some real.
But as Anne was saying in that Bloomberg thing, we are seeing a definite change in economics, which you guys aren't afraid of because you've already had to run it with different economics of acquisition and so forth. But the big banks who are like the regional banks in the US who are dependent on someone walking into a physical bank branch to open an account, they're sort of screwed with this change of economics, right?
Well, you know, there are still reasons to have branches. We have five financial centers in one branch, so it's not like I'm a branch expert. But I mean, if you have a small business footprint, that's still heavy on cash. I mean, there's reasons.
Yeah, but I would put it this way, Neff. I think mm-hmm. you could survive without branches as a bank today, but you can't survive without digital, right?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Well, Brett. Sorry to cut you off there, Neff. I want to ask a question, Brett, of your experience. I think you'll have a good perspective on this. I think we confuse sometimes that digital is the means, not the end. And as I was reflecting on why does it work so well for USAA is you never lost sight of it is a way to actually fix some of your other challenges. Like you can't have that many branches, you know, spread around the world. And so you never lost sight of how you're going to execute that. And so, Brett, I have the question for you is, so TD started thinking about this. You know, why did they decide to partner with Movin versus build that in-house, right, in terms of that separate app and keeping it a separate experience?
Well, mainly cost. I mean, we could do it at 1/10, 1/20 of the cost of them deploying it internally. So, you know, TD is over the eight years of the initial contractual relationship we have with TD, they'll probably spend north of $22 million over 8 years. But they were looking at, you know, if they were going to do this internally, costs of somewhere between $70 to $150 million to deploy it internally in 2 years, right? And so the cost allocation or the costs were very simple. The other thing was the reason we launched two apps, Neff, was for TD because they launched TD MySpend, which MySpend's been hugely successful for TD. A couple of million users in Canada now. TD MySpend users spend 5 to 8% less than those that don't use the app. Through awareness of their spending, attrition rate on MySpend users has dropped to zero virtually. So it's been super successful for them. But the reason they wanted to do a separate app was primarily that the rate of evolution of MySpend in those early days didn't fit their release cycle for the main app. We could be more aggressive about our update cycles and things like that, and they had more flexibility with our platform than the primary banking app. So that was the reason they did it. We are integrating more and more of MySpend into the TD's primary app, and over time I could see them merging back together. But at the time, it was really about the flexibility and evolution of the platform. And that's another reason why TD came to us, is that they felt that we could innovate faster on this, being sort of independent as a fintech without that legacy infrastructure and legacy process and policy. So cost and speed to market.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, Brett, in that context. And I also just have to clarify, I wouldn't rule out, specialty apps in USA's future. And we have launched some standalone apps. I did something called the USA Savings Coach back in 2015. It was sort of an unfortunate eagle-looking guy with a leather jacket, I think, at one point in its iteration. But it was meant to be sort of an agent that would help you save money on your everyday purchases. And that was really experimental. It was built on top of a virtual agent software with one of our partners. And, we did have some sort of short-run success in terms of encouraging savings and building up some momentum around it. Sort of won the prototype but didn't win the longer-term war, yeah. Which would, you know, we didn't understand how gamification, if you will, requires an awful lot of commitment on the back end and new games every month and, you know, there was just a sort of a robust operational architecture there that we hadn't really perceived. So we learned a lot from that. And, you know, when we retired it was sort of no harm, no foul. And I think that makes a lot of sense. If you're just going to try out a specific use case, or if there's something that, you know, you're trying to understand about your audience, or if there's a new market that you're trying to enter, I think it makes a ton of sense in that scenario. If you're trying to go full service in two different apps, it gets to be.
No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. And I think that's why eventually it'll merge, is that they weren't sure that MySpend was going to become a dominant sort of engagement experience and was going to become part of the fabric of engagement for TD customers. Now that it has, it makes sense to integrate those two. So I could see that happening, and we are having those discussions. But hey, listen, Neff, let's just have a quick break, and then we can continue the conversation after the break. Hey guys, it takes a lot to put on a podcast like this. We've got a team of a cast of many behind the scenes getting this. So it's really important for us to have sponsors. We're really grateful that LinkedIn has been a great sponsor for us. And so we're grateful for their investment in the show and the podcast and their trust in us. But I will tell you that for us, we're moving, when we're looking at new hires, we're hiring people on our AI and data science team right now. If you're building your team to tackle a problem like digital transformation, you're looking for the best person of the job, for the job, you're going to find that person at the end of the day on LinkedIn. More Americans are on the LinkedIn platform. We see this globally now, LinkedIn rolling out across all these different countries. And the LinkedIn job framework, LinkedIn jobs, makes it really easy to get matched with quality candidates who make sense for these tactical roles. They have, you can look at both hard skills and soft skills and profile. You've got people logging on to LinkedIn on average. Most LinkedIn users are using the site a couple of times a day. So, when you're looking at that activity and you see how people are responding, you're getting more flavor than just seeing someone's resume. You're seeing what they're interested in, what they're looking for, what's important to them, the comments and the conversations they're having. It's a great way not only to look at someone's skills in the background, but see what they're really passionate about and see if that matches with the organization. So I will say to you guys, if you are looking at doing a job posting, check out LinkedIn Jobs. It's the number one in delivering quality hires in the market. You can post a job today at linkedin.com/fintech. That is linkedin.com/fintech. And you get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/fintech. Terms and conditions apply. All right, you're listening to Breaking Banks. Brett King here. Jason Henricks is co-hosting with me today. We'll be right back after this break.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed, by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Neff, as we are closing out the last segment, we talk quite a bit about technology, technology stacks, the cost. Brett brought up the, you know, just the pace of innovation. In fact, one of the reasons TD partnered with MoveIn was they couldn't keep up with the release cycle. I'm curious, with the USAA transformation, what posed the greatest challenge? Was it changing the customer expectations and how they interacted? Was it the technology? Was it your people and your processes? What actually did you find was the most difficult aspect of that journey?
Well, I really feel like we got changed from the outside in. I think customer expectations really drove what we did and still today drive what we do. In the early days, we did struggle a bit with the technology and getting on the right pace. I mean, I remember getting to a monthly release was just really, really painful for a while. And then, of course, we got down to weekly and in some cases daily releases, right, as we progressed with that and adopted more agile methodology. So I think the technology piece was hard at the beginning. The people in the process is the toughest thing to change internally because, you know, you tend to grow up thinking about product. And you get good at it and you need to think about experience and you need to think about the customer on the other end, and that needs to permeate the whole organization. So our customer service representatives, who we call member service representatives, got that message really early. They've always been about taking care of the member, but really divorcing yourself from just like running a great product and understanding that it's really about serving someone's, meeting people's needs. That's always the focus that leads to a true transformation.
You know, you're a lot more like a credit union in regard to referring to people as members versus customers. And I think that's one of the reasons, thinking as members, that you really are customer driven in your approach to things, in that outside in, as you described. So who can become a member?
Does there a membership fee or to be a member?
If there is a membership fee, it's called serving your country. So, we are open to all of those who have served in the U.S. military honorably, and their descendants, which today has amounted to about 13 million members. We're sort of catching the tail end of the greatest generation. And then, of course, all the vets from the forever wars for the last 20 years. So, but we are focused on one market, the U.S. military market and their families. And we report to them. We have we don't report to shareholders. We report to our members. If we have a great year, then we give the money back in the form of dividends and distributions. So I think that really keeps us focused on who we're serving, and it gives them, great insight into whether or not we're doing that job, right? So there, we both our membership and USAA have a shared interest in really making digital work.
So, great. Well, that's a good way to finish it up. So go to usaa.com to check out what's happening over there with digital. Once again, Neff, I think you guys have done a phenomenal job. I've cited you guys in Bank 4.0 as one of the first incumbent banks in the U.S. to truly get digital and tech. So, my hat off to you. You guys have walked the talk.
Well, thanks, Brett, and look forward to seeing what the future brings. We got a lot of work to do.
Great. Fantastic. Well, stick around if you want to join in the conversation, Neff. You're welcome to. Also joining us all the way from Munich, I presume he's in Munich today, Paolo Cerroni. Where are you in the world today, Paolo?
I'm actually Milano.
Milano, Italy. Okay, my apologies. But you're based in Munich, right?
I'm based in Germany, in Frankfurt.
Germany, okay. In Frankfurt, sorry. My apologies.
I would say
I'm not getting it right.
So much I travel.
Yes true. And thank goodness they've got Wi-Fi on Lufthansa these days. Now, Paolo, you, of course, lead one of the global leads for fintech at IBM. You focused especially on IBM Watson, technology and AI. You also published a bunch of books in the space on fintech. Your latest essay that we're going to get to in a moment is called Transparency, an essay on financial markets theory. So this is your latest effort. But of course, prior to that, you've done fintech innovation. You also wrote a book on MiFID II. Your books have been translated into multiple languages. But you're a bit of a economic theorist as well as a practitioner in the fintech space, right?
Well, I was a banker, I was a fintech entrepreneur, and now I'm working for IBM. So I'm the FinTech thought leader as a member of the IBM Industry Academy, which is a think tank that wants to aggregate conversations, bringing around the table the startup entrepreneurs, the industry representatives, the regulators, the technology players. And I want to add something which is very important. I don't forget the human being, because innovation needs to be used by people. Therefore, it has to create positive impact. Because you see, change can be good or bad. So we need to understand how to make sure that value is always preserved and actually enhanced.
So you were part of an acquisition that IBM made of a fintech?
Yes, so with a small fintech that I created in Germany. That's why now I have Italian based there, that was focusing on digital wealth management. And wealth management is always on my radar, because ultimately it's the secret sauce to fully digitize a financial institution, because of the way banks are changing from transactions to services on transparent markets. Therefore, the need to make sure that clients can remunerate transparently the services they receive from the bank. So I think it's a very interesting starting point that in the end maps into the concept of the advisory open banking digital platform that is underpinning some of the IBM solutions and strategic discussions with the marketplace, which explains basically the biological motivation of people to use digital. Because you mentioned yourself before.
Well, biological
means that people use it.
Biological motivation to use digital. That's very interesting. Why do you use that term?
Well, let's make an example which is just a bit outside the frame, but it explains to you what I'm talking about. When in the 90s they asked Jeff Bezos, what is Amazon? At the time, it was only selling books. So Jeff Bezos said, I'm not a distribution channel of books on the internet. He said the publisher are sending me letters complaining because I allow people to write negative reviews. And they said it's marketing stupid. Only put the positive ones so we can sell more. Now, Jeff Bezos responded, the publisher is not my client. My client is the one who buys the book. And my role is not to distribute the books. My primary role is to advise my client on which is the best book to buy. Because if the client doesn't understand, as he cannot touch the book, he will not buy, even if I can deliver it in 1 hour. Now, that was very ingenious, and yet, in essence, very simple as a way to solve it, because it simply allowed the peer reviews of literature. But banks did not understand that well. So while most of the banks thought that their primary focus in using AI and big data was to understand the client, they forgot that before that, there was a more compelling priority. The priority is not that the bank does not understand the client. The priority is that the client does not understand the bank. So when it's left alone on digital to be self-directed, it may not be capable of banking the way it should do. So we need, first and foremost, find a way to resolve this problem, because resolving this problem will enable digital to provide value to people. Therefore, you can then optimize the way the digital platform works in a way that you can generate more revenues. But first of all, you need to provide value to clients.
So this is, Jason, you've got a follow-up question here, but this is really sort of the art of like behavioral psychology and experience design and all of those elements, right?
Well, it goes a bit deeper than that, if you like, and that is the essence of this financial market transparency new book, because it is biological, not just psychological. Just yesterday, we had Richard Taylor in Milano speaking at a conference for financial advisors, and when he was asked, how do you foresee the improvement of the industry to provide value for a client, he did not respond to nudges. He said, transparency is the first thing to generate, because it is the starting point. Because you see, the nudge can improve here and there, but the nudge itself does not generate value in front of the client. Well, you need to generate value. Now, generating value, therefore, means understanding biologically why people are somehow...
How they perceive value.
Yeah. Well, how they perceive value. And that is what the Financial Market Transparency book talks about, because it explains how people make investment decisions in the presence of fundamental uncertainty over the reversible time. So there are two concepts, the one of uncertainty and the one of time. And I think this is really, really foundational for fintech as well as financial services, because if we don't understand where biologically the value of finance comes from, we will not be able to create sustainable and resilient financial services solutions that are powered by digital technology. So you can name a lot of different type of innovations. We can discuss blockchain, we can discuss AI, we can discuss quantum computing. But I tell you, the most complex innovation of all is the one that changes the way we believe the world works. And that is the power of transparency. We can also help us change the way business leaders believe the business model should look like in a bank. Because ultimately, the problem that the industry has is not technology. Technology is available. The problem is legacy leadership, because there is a difficulty of understanding in first principle ways how to create a very different business model that services the community in ways that were not there before.
So I want to build on that for a second, because I hear what you're saying, and idealistically, I love it. But if I think about my prototypical corporation and banks in particular and financial services thinking about this, my desire to use fundamental understanding of human motivation in that biology, my first instinct is not how do I create more value for the customer. My first instinct is how do I get them into things that are more valuable for me. And the antithesis of that is actually transparency, right? I'm actually trying to make that less and less transparent. As an example, by adding rewards to a credit card, I can actually get people to spend more than they intend to and carry balances is, you know, one of my favorite examples. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, that is actually the industry before the global financial crisis and a bit after. But a few things are happening here, because on one side, competition is lowering the margins. On the other side, digital itself is enabling you to compare services more clearly. And on the third side, regulators are asking the industry to be more transparent. You can clearly see this in Europe. The European Commission has conceived the MiFID II, which is a protection of the investors as a transparency regulation. Recently, they discussed about how to regulate ESG, therefore environment and social responsibility and governance. And the Mario Nava of the Director General for the Capital Markets Union said, we could have thought of a regulation that is based on incentives and punishment, but that is reactive. We prefer to think of transparency because that is proactive. So the intention is to force banks to be transparent so that they have to make an effort to generate and demonstrate value for the clients on a transparent world. Therefore, they need to understand on my side where value really is, and they need therefore to understand the biology, not only the psychology of investors. Otherwise, they do like some of the robotizers. They were out there, but clients are not on board, because digital is a technology of that demand, is a pull technology, while most of the banking services that can generate higher margins operate into a push modality, is an economy of the offer. And the reason why you have this demand-offer asymmetry is because of the biology of investors, which is still linked to the way we need to survive, the way we make decisions thinking or not thinking of uncertainty, and the fact that time is irreversible. Once we have invested the money, we cannot call them back. We are exposed to risk. We can make money or we can lose money. So we need to be made more responsible about our financial decisions.
So I'll jump in here, and then I know Jason's got a follow-up as well. But getting back to the sort of market transparency and so forth, one of the things that comes out in your essay is there's more uncertainty in the market. And so, you know, this is sort of really key to your financial markets theory is, you know, when you look at Adam Smith and the invisible hand and looking at this, we expect markets to act rationally. But one of your key theses are that that's no longer happening, that where the markets are tending increasingly to introduce irrationality, into this, and that's creating uncertainty. And so that economic uncertainty, we see that presenting itself in Brexit and Trump and, Bernie Sanders and AOC with the socialist movement, they're coming sort of from this common place, is we're not sure about our economic future, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me answer this question talking about economics, and then we make a parallelism to computing science when we discuss research for artificial intelligence, because uncertainty is a key element that will also define the future of artificial intelligence. In 2009, after the default of Lehman Brothers, Alan Greenspan was asked in front of the US Senate to respond to the policymakers of the United States question, why did it happen? So now Alan Greenspan said, honestly, we found a flaw in the model. He said, we thought the model was working. It seemed to work for 40 years. It doesn't work anymore. And we don't know if we'll ever work again because the investors, the agents, are not rational. Therefore, the markets don't reach efficiency and equilibrium. Now, the response of the industry was somehow threefold. On the one side, the behavioral scientists thought that if you can nudge someone that is irrational, it can go back to become rational. But they make a mistake here because biologically, we are both rational and irrational. Because the rationality applies when we have a sufficient set of information to make a decision, but the big data will never contain all of the information we need. Therefore, we need a sentimental element, an irrational element, an element of imagination about the future world. How will the environment look like in 50 years? How will the society will look like in 50 years? What happens if I make this investment and something pops up that is completely unexpected? Imagination is an emotional element. So you need to understand that human being is like a yin-yang, is jointly rational and irrational, right? So then, if you start from this point, which was tackled by behavioral finance, you can link something that happened still in the 1990s, which is a fabulous book of Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize for Economics. He wrote The Age of Diminished Expectations. And he goes back to the uncertainty element because he said that the children of American families today have less opportunities than their parents to make more money. Therefore, they have lower expectations. That means that there is higher anxiety, higher uncertainty, which will therefore create social instability in the future. And he made an example in the 1990s saying that at that time, at least 50% of the students of American universities were children of alumni. So therefore, he said, meritocracy in the U.S. is broken. Now, a few months ago, you remember, there was a scandal about parents bribing universities to get their children in. So I believe that Paul Krugman had a very long sight on what was happening in America. Now, if you fast forward 20 years after, this is what is happening. As wealth started polarizing again, a lot of U.S. Americans, such as a lot of people in the Western world, you can think about the southern countries in Europe, started feeling to be left out of the economic enhancement. For the first time, capitalism is not inclusive anymore, but starts to be exclusive. This takes time, but in the end, uncertainty is raised to the unconsciousness of people. And that's when people start changing their behavior. They were behaving in a certain way before that is sort of rational. They behave in another way now that is considered irrational. But the element underneath all of this is the amount of uncertainty. And you know that uncertainty is growing on the world stage.
Yeah. Have you read Will Durant, The Lessons of History?
Yes. No, I haven't read it, but you can.
So I'll tell you why it's really interesting because, you know, and David Brin introduced me to this. I know we've got to wrap this up actually, you know, in a couple of minutes. So Jason's getting ready to wind us up with the closing announcements. But in Will Durant, he came up with this idea that if you look at history and civilization, you really have two basic social structures. You have a diamond-shaped social structure where wealth is distributed across the participants in the economy, across the citizens, and you have a pyramid-shaped social structure, where the wealth is designed to flow up to the elite or the 1%, right? And that the diamond-shaped structures are the most prosperous economies we've ever seen throughout history. You know, the wealth distribution is more even, follows a bell curve. You know, it's growth is predictable and sustainable and so forth. But those models are inherently unstable because the elite always want to flatten it out to be a pyramid shape again. And so isn't that the sort of thing we're seeing in the US and the UK? And isn't that why we have this economic uncertainty now, because of inequality?
Well, it's part of that. If you look at the wealth distribution in the 1940s, the top 0.1% of U.S. Families owned 20% of wealth, which is the same amount of the bottom 90%. In the mid-80s, the bottom 90% owned 35%. Against the top 0.1%, they went down to 10%. Now we are back to 22% each. So you see, we are going back in time with another element that.
Just so, Paolo, we've just got 30 seconds left. So wrap it up.
Yes. Change is happening very fast. Very, very fast, because digital is speeding up everything. Only when technology is transparent, only if decision making is transparent, we can transform change into progress, and we don't leave out anybody, because people understand what is happening. Otherwise, we create opacity even with technology, and there will be no generate good tech. We want good tech to build good finance. That's why we need transparency.
Very nicely summed up. Jason?
Yeah, very nicely summed up, and I think we actually need to have Paolo come back, because we didn't even get into the AI implications on if we just abdicate all of this to the machines, will they make the perfectly rational long-term that serve our long-term best interests?
I welcome our robot overlords.
Quickly, Paolo. Something here very fast. The big problem here in this reasoning is that you cannot make it more rational, because the human, as we said, is not purely rational. The economics doesn't exist. The problem with AI, there's a problem, is that uncertainty is not part of big data, because the future is open. So most of the research today is about biological models that try to map complex systems in a way that they don't look for stability, which will break, but anti-fragility.
Okay. Yeah. We've got to wrap it up, Paolo. Adapting.
Yeah, well, thanks for our guests. Thanks to our guests, Neff Hudson and Paolo Cerrone. Hey, if you want to continue the conversation, jump in at BreakingBanks1 on Twitter. You can also email us at info@provoke.fm. If you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment, reach out. Same channels, info@provoke.fm. And if you like the show, show us your support in another way. Give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps new listeners find the show. And if you want more, you can download and listen to more than 300 episodes of Breaking Banks and our other shows like FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. That's it for this week. Fascinating conversation. Thanks again to both Neff and Paolo. And we'll see you again next week for more Breaking Banks. Oh, yeah.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.